What is the person made of? What is the mind before the person existed? Have you heard that one before? We're getting close to the real koans. What happens on these retreats, statistically speaking, is about 75% of people, 45% of people, actually get to the point of feeling it's okay to be themselves, and will then continue to work further. And some, very rarely, may actually have a Kensho experience, not usually on retreat, but separately after the retreat. A Kensho experience, by definition, is simply one in which all self-concern drops away. And that begins to enter a sort of technical psychology of Zen, and I don't want to push that one too far. But if you can imagine a self in which the concern about me has simply fallen away, that's just about a definition of an enlightenment experience. Such an experience can arise, but it's rare in the Western Zen. Well, it's always rare. The best result in a Western Zen retreat is usually what Shifu would call a one-mind experience. That is a feeling of oneness with everybody. Love of everybody on the retreat, love of everybody else, and a feeling of really positive affirmation about the world. A feeling of oneness with it. And that can be a very strange feeling, because you remember I referred to before that when you meditate a lot, the boundaries of time and space dissolve. So you may, as it were, come out of the Chan Hall and look at the hills, and suddenly the hills and everything around it appears to be part of you. There is no difference. That is a yogic experience, which is a consequence of the practice of the meditation. So we're talking here not about simply the answering of a question. We're talking about a transformation in the very psyche itself, in which the yogic process of meditation plus the intellectual endeavor of working with the question combined to produce what in Sanskrit is called paravritti, a turning around within consciousness itself. To use the language we were talking about before, you've dropped out of the three times. For a brief while, you are totally there in the moving present. You could say, in the presence of presence. Well, that's the Western Zen retreat, which we do, and many people have benefited from it, and many people find that a very useful introduction to the Dharma. And I personally think it's an exceptionally good introduction to the Dharma for the following reason. It would be perfectly possible to do a lot of mind calming without actually asking who you are. You could get into the habit of doing a lot of samatha or a lot of vipassana, sitting on your backside, calming the mind, but actually none of the difficulties are being resolved because none of them are coming up. You are simply calming the mind, but the gunge is still there. And as soon as you get into an argument with somebody, up it will all come. So actually, you're not learning Dharma just by sitting. There has to be more to it than that. You have to confront yourself. And I put it to you that in Zen, in Chan, the number one thing we all have to do if we're interested in Chan is to confront ourselves. And that's hard, because certainly some of it will be unacceptable or not very good. The way I've described in this Western Zen retreat is simply one way of doing that. Of course, there are other ways of confronting oneself, or I can still do it on a question, who am I, just by sitting on a cushion. But it takes longer, because you cannot offload the stuff in the way that happens in the sharing. So Berner is right in that sharing speeds up the process. Actually, through the sharing and the discovering that it's possible to trust another to listen to one's not very pleasant aspects of oneself, one's selfishness, one's greed, one's addictions, one's prejudices, All of that stuff has to come out, the lot. You may be prejudiced and not know it. You may be prejudiced against a class of people in the community and think that you're a fine fellow until you get into a who am I situation when you suddenly realize that, oh God, I didn't realize I was quite as prejudiced against the so-and-sos as I thought. You might come across that. And that would be quite shocking if one is a well-intentioned person. To discover hidden prejudice is very important, because without discovering it, you can't do anything about it. You will just manifest it in some way, like remarks at a dinner party which give it away, etc., etc. So confronting with the self is very, very important. I would say not only the opening gambit, but perhaps the most important gambit of all in the practice of Chan. Now I want to talk a little bit about the old koan stories and how they can be used. These old koan stories are quite complex and long, so I think the best way to start is to tell one so that we have an old koan story to work with. Here's a rather nice koan story which raises some difficulties. In the old days in China, monks used to wander around from monastery to monastery, visiting masters and finding out what they could learn, and also getting a free meal or two, no doubt. Anyway, one day there was this monk, pretty scruffy, turns up at monastery, opens the door, marches in. He's really very untidy. He's probably been walking for at least a week without a bath. Anyway, he goes in to the Chan Hall, opens the Chan Hall, looks around. It's a beautiful Chan Hall. Statues of the Buddha, scrolls on the wall, wonderful calligraphy. He looks around, he goes, bah! Turns around and walks out. But when he gets to the front gate, he thinks, oh, I was a bit hasty. Yeah, I was a bit too hasty. I think I'll go back. So he goes back. By this time, the master has come into the Chan Hall, is sitting on his throne, and the master raises his fly whisk in welcome. What does the monk do? He says, bah! And walks out. This time he doesn't come back. Afterwards, the master says to the guest master, what's happened to that noisy fellow? The guest master says, he's gone away. And the master says, that guy will end up building monasteries on the tops of mountains and abusing and swearing at the Buddhas and patriarchs. Question. In saying that, was the master approving or disapproving of the monk? Think about it. Now, there's a rather nice kind of story, because what it's clearly about is about a split between earthy Zen practice, just being oneself in the wilderness and, you know, getting on with things, lighting a fire, doing your own cooking and living in a pretty primitive way, but in total honesty with nature, and then coming into an institutionalized hall with all the decorations and architecture and pomp and circumstance, institutionalization, masters in glowing robes with fly whisks. Bah! What do I want with all that stuff? So there's a problem here. What is the place of beautiful buildings in Chan? But you could put it round the other way and say, surely this man should have better manners than that. So you can argue it either from the point of view of somebody who says, oh, these temples are terribly important, one must never insult a temple, one must always make one's three prostrations and crossing the floor and do all that. You can't just shout, bah, and walk off. That's disgusting behavior. Don't approve of that at all. On the other hand, you might say, oh, I don't bother about these temples. Mountaintops are much better for me. Caves are a proper place. I just like to live in caves and yes, and pick nettles, like Milarepa. Which way is right? Which view is right? Are they both right? How do they relate? You're faced with a duality here. That's the subtlety of the koan. It throws you into a duality, either or. Where is the third place? If you find the third place, you've solved the koan. Okay, that's just the example of one particular koan and the way in which it throws up dilemmas for those who want to practice. Because it's not clear when the master says, oh, that guy, one day he'll build monasteries on the tops of mountains and he'll shout curses at the Buddhas and the patriarchs. Was he not pleased with the man? Or did he actually say, he's going to be one of my Dharma heirs? Which was it? Or was it neither of those, but something else? There you have a beautiful koan. Now you can obviously spend weeks thinking about that one. But the way to solve koans is not so much through thinking about them as trying to be yourself in the picture. So, we created in our Western Chan Fellowship a way of working with koans which we think suits the westernized mind. Why? Well, we Westerners, and also all Chinese who have had Western educations, are taught to think. To think, to reason, to argue, to rationalize, to explain. Above all, to explain. Everything has to be explained. The media are always on about explaining why this happens, why that happens, why so-and-so did this, why, always why, explain. One day I went to Shifu. I was thinking about my own practice as a scientist, and I said to Shifu, the trouble with me, Shifu, is that I'm always trying to explain everything. And Shifu says, exactly, John, that's why your practice should be silence. Thank you, Shifu. End of interview. Right. Well, knowing that not only myself, but at least most high school educated Westerners, and certainly most university educated Westerners, have this tremendous addiction to explaining everything. And because koan stories are not easily explained, I thought, well, why don't we resurrect all these old koan stories and let people try and explain them and see what happens when they get really stuck? That would be interesting. There was another reason why I wanted to do this, and that is that, normally speaking nowadays, the full koan story is not often used on retreats. Shifu, for example, although he will talk about koan stories in his teisho, in his sermons, he prefers to use huadu in actual retreats. And, of course, that we do the same. At times, we use huatu also. Huatu are very useful. But I wondered why. Why don't we use these extraordinary old stories? So I thought, right, well, supposing we had a retreat in which we have a number of different koan stories, and we let people choose which one they want to try to understand. So, we have a piece of paper. I've got an example here. It's a list of about 8 koan stories, all of them pretty tricky. And people have said, right, go away with these pieces of paper, read these stories, and choose one of them as your koan to work on for 10-day retreat, or, well, usually in our case, 6-day retreat. So people have a whole morning to go outside, read these koan stories. Then I say, have you chosen? People say yes, or they may have to have an interview to decide which one. But eventually, they all choose a koan story. Now, what's happening here? What is it that causes somebody to choose a particular koan story rather than another one? Because the message is, the way to choose a koan story is to find out which story seems to be telling you something. You may not know what it is, but it's hinting at something. It's telling you something. It's intriguing. It's puzzling. It's difficult. Now, only you would have that thought. Therefore, when a koan interests you in that way, it is actually triggering something of your life koan. You see the point, that in a sense, nobody else can choose your koan. Only you can choose your koan. So when you choose a koan, it's you that does it. And there must be some kind of relationship between your life koan, that's to say the whole of your life story, and this koan, which is saying something to you, even though you don't quite know what it is. Well, most people, well, nearly everybody, finally chooses a koan story. And if they don't, we provide them with a nice, easy huatu to work on. But that's not easy always either, of course. So then people sit down and they are told, okay, you're all Western educated, now explain this koan. So they all said, we're thinking about it. And then we say, all explanations are going to be wrong, but keep trying because it's interesting. You will find that you can explain this story in about 10 different ways. How many have you got? Five. How many have you got? Three. And every time you've got an explanation, realize that it cannot be the full story because you're not dealing with something which can be explained rationally because the stories are paradoxes. Now, we have to know what a paradox is. A paradox is something like a riddle because it's pointing outside itself at something else. Now, that's the mystery of the koan. The paradox is that it's hinting at something beyond itself. What is it hinting at? If you can find out what it's hinting at, the master might pass it. And what it will be is something to do with the solution of your life koan. Because by the time you've worked for 6 or 7 days on a koan and discarded all the experiences and all the explanations which have come up, where you end up in is in the classical great doubt, which is described for classical koan work. You end up fixated on maybe just 2 words of the story. Really stuck. Those words have got stuck in your head. You can't get rid of them. They go round and round and round. The story has almost disappeared. You're in what's called the great doubt. And that great doubt is something which has become deeply personal. It's in your own heart, and you don't know why or wherefore. It's working at levels of the mind which are not accessible to reason. But then something happens. It twists around, and you say, of course. And I can't tell you what, because actually the of course in its first manifestation is not in words. I put it to you, what has probably happened is that that person has dropped out of time. And in the moment of dropping out of time, they see the present moment. But it's coloured by the mystery of the paradox they've been working with. So that when the master says, what is it? They'll come up with some phrase which simply indicates something, but the master feels, yeah, it fits. He'll say, fine, three prostrations to the Buddha and have a nice walk, enjoy, or whatever. That's the sort of thing Shifu says. So these koans are very interesting. Now, we cannot sit here and solve koans for reasons which are obvious. I can cook up some koans and we can all try and explain them, but we haven't got time to work through the koans to this extraordinary moment when, in the intensity of the great doubt, the thing dissolves and drops away and leaves us timeless, spacious, gawping out some word which we'll just have to do. How does the master know? Not verbally. It's in the non-verbal appearance of such a person. They are released. Koan is gone. The eye energy is brilliant. the facial expression is totally, how shall I put it, different. Maybe delighted. Maybe just very, very open. Maybe an expression of wonder. And when people self-quant in that way, the real test as to whether it's a solution or not is whether it has any effect on their lives. And people for whom the solution of a koan has really and truly worked say, the Dharma is no longer a puzzle to me. I understand the Dharma. It's quite straightforward. Or they will say, life is actually okay. I may have trouble again, but I know that life basically is okay, in spite of the fact that it's still difficult. In other words, some kind of a faith in life itself has emerged. And we could call that the fruit of the Dharma, this sense of belonging to life and manifesting life. And of course, when you're in that frame of mind, you can't make a mistake, because it is closely related to love. A very curious kind of love, which is disinterested, a love which is for everything and everybody. So that when you meet people, you'll be surprised that they'll start talking to you as if they've known you since you were born, because intuitively they will sense that you are completely open to hear what they have to say. You no longer have a side. Now, we're in danger of speaking idealistically here, because these events, after all, are quite rare. It also has to be said that they may be of rather short duration, because the difficulties of life don't get away so easily. But once one has seen something of that kind, faith, Dharma faith, can appear, and one can work with that. Now, I'd like to finish this talk by actually talking about one or two of these koans, because it's worth looking at them, because they are of different kinds. Right. Well, let's take... when I say there are different kinds, I mean they work in rather different ways. So we cannot solve these koans. I warn you, we're not solving koans here. We are actually exploring their nature and what they're pointing towards. We cannot actually solve them, because that's beyond words, and I'm just talking words. However, here's a nice story. It was a beautiful summer's day, really lovely. The windows of the Chan Hall were wide open, and the monks were all sitting there waiting for the arrival of the master. The master arrives, looks around the Chan Hall, climbs into his seat, and raises his fly whisk to begin his talk. At that moment, a bird in the garden begins to sing. The master holds up the stick. The bird goes on singing. The monks are all wondering what's going to happen next. The bird goes on singing. Finally, the bird stops. The master puts down the fly whisk and says, "Oh, monks, that is all for today," and returns to his room. Which of the monks got it? Now you can imagine the monks. There will be those monks who think, "What's the old so-and-so on about? You know, this is ridiculous. Why doesn't he give his sermon?" They haven't even heard the bird song, of course. Other monks will think, "Well, he must be in a peculiar mood today. Maybe he needs an aspirin." Other monks, however, might hear the bird song. And they might think that that's better than any sermon. And they will experience something as a result of the birdsong. Maybe what they will experience is the total presence of the birdsong in the presence of that present moment. And in that total openness to that flowing nowness, they may see something which goes beyond the chant hall, beyond the bird, and indeed beyond the master. Meanwhile, the master has gone back to his room, and I bet he's having a chuckle. Now, what kind of a koan is that? Well, it belongs to a kind of koan which evokes a state of mind. You see, it's not like the ba one. It's not that the master has made some statement which can be interpreted in one of two ways. It's not that sort of koan. This is a koan which deliberately evokes the state of mind of someone who is able to fall into the beauty of the present moment and catch what the master is pointing out. So we'll call that type of koan evocation of a state. And because it's rather a poetic story, we can, I think, get some sense of its meaning. It touches us, just the story. It's a beautiful story. But the same thing can be said in a koan which is much shorter, sharper, and blunt. That's the story of Master Gute. It's a very short koan. Every time Master Gute was asked a question, he raised his finger. What's he pointing to? What is it? The story of Master Gute's finger has an unfortunate conclusion. If I remember it right, there was a little boy in the monastery who took to imitating Master Gute. The little boy, whenever the little boy was asked the question, it would go like this. So I think the story, not quite sure, but I think it goes like this, that somebody came into the courtyard and said, "Where's Master Gute?" And the boy raised his finger like this. And the master grabbed him and cut it off. And the boy was running away, crying, when the master went, and the boy was enlightened. Well, well. Here's another one. This is insight through a word. Story goes like this. The Buddha was out walking with the gods. They were walking along, having a good chat, when the master, well, that's to say the Buddha, when the Buddha lifted up his finger, pointed to the ground and said, "That would be a good place to build a sanctuary." And Indra, who is the king of the gods, picked a blade of grass and stuck it there and said, "The sanctuary is built." End of story. What is the sanctuary? Why is a blade of grass sufficient for the sanctuary? What was the Buddha up to? That koan is actually turned out to be quite a popular one in the group I go to in Bristol. There was one lady there who was very troubled with her life and was saying, "I want to know what the Buddha refuge is." So I thought, refuge, sanctuary, rather similar words. So I said, "I'll give you a koan to work on." So I gave her this koan. She loved it. She's still carrying it around with her, so far as I know. She discovered a sanctuary in her mind every time she told the story to herself. The sanctuary was, of course, herself. Why not? Where else? If you have a sanctuary, where else can it be? Only one place. Here's another one. This is really quite tricky because it refers to Buddhist philosophy. But I'll give it to you because some of you might have been reading a bit of philosophy and might enjoy this. How does it go? Oh, yeah. It's about the start of the Mahayana. You know, there was the Theravada, and then the more developed schools of Buddhism, the Mahayana, developed. So the gods, again, the gods were having a wonderful celebration because the Mahayana had started, and they were all rushing around drinking orange juice. Saying to one another, how wonderful today, this is the second time the Tathagata has proclaimed the Dharma. Whoopee! The Buddha was sitting next to Subhuti. He nudged Subhuti and he said, it's not the second time, Subhuti, because there never was a first time. How about that? Of course, what that picks up on is various ideas about emptiness and timelessness. Right. So, there we have a koan which requires you to pick up some insight, a Dharma insight. And you may or may not get it. But it's a good story. There's another nice one. How are we doing for time? Right. I'll tell you three more, then I'll promise I'll stop. Trouble is, I could go on with these stories all night because I love these stories. There's a story of Great Master Joshu who came to see equally Great Master Linchi. So Joshu, obviously going on pilgrimage, comes into the monastery, and when he arrives, he finds that Linchi is washing his feet. And Joshu, a bit clever, says, what is the meaning of Buddha Dharma's coming from the West? Which, after all, was a very common question. Linchi says, oh, just now I happen to be washing my feet. So Joshu came closer, expecting to hear more. Linchi looked up and said, so, do I have to toss out a second ladle full of dirty water? This is one of those koans which points that actually the Dharma is wordless. The secret of the Dharma. We've been talking about timelessness and spaciousness of the Dharma in certain yogic experiences which give us an insight into the basis of mind, sometimes called Buddha nature. When we see into that Buddha nature, there are actually no words, because the seeing itself is beyond language. So we struggle to create words to talk about it. But actually, when one sees as clearly as that into Buddha nature, there are no words. There's timeless spaciousness. There is a monk once asked a pilgrim, what is your style of practice? The pilgrim said, well, I wrap up my sandals in my robe. Curious thing to do if you're on pilgrimage. You should have your sandals on your feet. But this man says, no, I wrap up my sandals in my robe. So the monk says, what on earth do you mean? The monk says, the pilgrim says, I go down the hill barefoot. Very nice one. If you're investigating the Dharma, don't take anything with you. You remember the great master Huineng was enlightened when he heard one line from the Dharma Sutra. And in a very free translation, that mind said, let the mind arise, but don't put it anywhere. In other words, let the full awareness of being in this room, in this moment, arise, but don't attach your mind to any judgment about it. Just be aware. Always, everywhere, every time. But don't be fooled by that remark. It doesn't mean to say that there are other times when you have to think practically about the fact that if you really want to go down this difficult mountain, you better put your sandals on. Last one. I have to give you this one because it's about Shifu in London, when I was with Shifu. I refer to myself here as Layman John. Shifu and Layman John were walking in Westminster Square, which you may know is in the heart of London. A great swirl of traffic was passing around it. The engines were roaring, the horns were hooting. Suddenly, in amongst the turning wheels, John saw a pile of horse dung, neatly stacked exactly as it had fallen, and quite undisturbed by the traffic. It seemed incredible that a living horse could have passed that way in all that traffic and left so clear and neat a testimony to its passage. Layman John drew Shifu's attention to the unlikely pile, saying, Shifu, look, here's a pile of horse shit. But where's the horse? Shifu looked at it and said, what need have we of the horse? Yeah, we can have some questions if you like.
John, would you remind the author? Yes. You can.
Sorry?
If anyone doesn't want to be videotaping, then I'm videotaping. Anyone doesn't want to be videotaping, you can let your head go around. Maybe that's a question I would mind. So,
do I understand? Anybody who wants to ask a question, grab the microphone. Okay. They're recording it. Yeah, please.
Is this just for that?
No, that's what you could.
Okay, because I don't hear it over here. It's just for you.
Yeah, it's for me.
Okay.
That's it.
Can I talk to you?
No.
No, you talk to me. I won't answer unless you talk to me.
This questioning method.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
Is something that I feel uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you describe it is intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a method that is expedient.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, why would it take so long to discover? It seems like it's taken forever, mm-hmm. 2,500 years to discover this method.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there are so many brilliant minds mm-hmm. between from Buddha to now, that if it's so expedient and so useful, why do you think it might not have been used? I've never really heard of this until now, and Shifu hasn't used this method, and he's probably known about it for a number of years now.
Mm.
It's not being used yet, anyhow. Mm. But again, I'm intrigued by the method, but I can't say I feel comfortable doing it.
But have you tried it?
I was trying it as you were talking about.
Oh, no, that won't do. As a matter of fact, well, to answer your question, I don't really know why no one has thought of it before, but there's a sense in which it has always existed. You see, the koan stories themselves are encounters. The koan stories I've been telling you are all encounters between a monk and a monk, or a monk and a master, and they are all encounters about the Dharma. It seemed that in the in those ancient days, when Chan first was starting in China, the teachers were puzzled as to how to teach it, because there was a lot of very abstract philosophy. And you could go and talk about abstract philosophy till kingdom come, and some people did, and they became the great philosophers of China. But other people wanted much more direct teaching. So these masters knew that there was this direct and immediate insight outside the scriptures. And so they would try and nudge their monks into understanding it by asking them koan questions. Like, who are you then, before your mother was born? That sort of thing. And if the monk was in the right kind of mood, if he'd been meditating all morning and was really high, he might get the answer. So you see that actually the encounter dialogue is very, very old. This is only, I think, a modern, as it were, version of it. How Berner, when he invented this system, he said, why on earth does a meditating monk have to wait so long to take his answer to the master? Why don't the monks share it with one another? And then he thought, well, let's try it. He was a very experimental character. So he used to have sitting meditation retreats, and one day he said, right, well, let's share a question. And the obvious question, the simplest one, is who are you? That's how it began. But the tradition of what's called encounter dialogue, in not exactly that form, but in similar forms, is a very old one. Now, as to doing it, I can't say anything else except try it, because most people find it very scary. But if you plunge in, you can find it very, very valuable. That's all I can say about that. Please.
Sorry,
is a very interesting question. And yes, you are right. There's a sense in which a person's karma is not disposed of. What happens is that it is seen through. Now that's different. You see, it is quite true that after the retreat, people who have had a successful retreat are really quite free and liberated to be themselves for some days. In fact, some people are too liberated and need a certain amount of care, because it's can be a very overwhelming experience. But it is true that one's patterns of one's life, what you might call one's life narrative, is not destroyed by an activity of that kind. One remains oneself in the sense of one's personal structure. And that will begin to reappear after some time. And that faces those of us who run these retreats with a bit of a problem, because people complain of a sort of yo-yo effect. You can come on a retreat, you feel much better, but then after a bit you have to come back again and do another one. And we think that's not quite good enough. So actually, the answer to that is that we also recommend people, having done that retreat, also to practice other methods such as silent illumination, which are, as it were, a non-verbal approach. What has happened, if I may put it this way, in doing that kind of dialogue, is that one sees through one's own narrative. And in that seeing through, one can, as it were, digest it. And although it's not gone, one is now familiarized oneself with one's karma in a way which enables one to use one's life perhaps rather differently. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I feel about it.
So is it the beginning of a process of learning to deal with one's weaknesses in such a way as to eventually eliminate them in some way?
Yes. I mean, there is a question there, to use your word, exactly what elimination would be. But certainly there is a process of change. I've known people, I can give you an example of a personal story of someone who came on our retreats, very, very shy, almost incapable to participate in the exercise, but with considerable and very obvious courage, tried to do so. After some time in interview, we discovered that this man had been in prison for some years for having attempted to burn down his parents' house with them inside and the door locked. He hadn't succeeded, but in a trial for arson, he'd been given something like 5 years in prison. He was so ashamed of this and so difficult, so diffident about it, that he had never been able to speak about it with anyone in prison, nor with a counselor. The prison service had not done anything for this man whatsoever. And so when he came to us, he was really a deeply bottled up, almost non-communicating person. I don't quite know what brought him to such a dangerous thing as our retreat, but he came, and believe it or not, he began to talk about it. He then came to more retreats. And after he'd done, I suppose, about 5 or 6 retreats, he is now really quite an ordinary kind of citizen. He's holding down a job, teaches languages, and so on. His life is by no means a particularly easy one. He's an extremely shy person, but he is very, very different from how he was when we first met him. And there are other similar stories like that. That's rather a dramatic story. But there are other stories which are more ordinary than that. But I told you a dramatic one because it makes a point. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I'm struggling with the attempt to understand to what degree he has become a different person as a result of these experiences.
Yes. Well, I agree, that's a good question. All one can say about that is that by the criteria of the person's normal behavior, he was being able to talk with people, being able to laugh and being able to joke, being able to enjoy a beer in a pub. All of those kinds of things were now much more ordinary than when this extremely shy and bottled up person first appeared. So it's the criterion here, I would say, actually is, quotes, normality.
So to sum up, would it be true to say that in essence he is now more comfortable in his skin?
Yes, entirely. Absolutely right. That's it. Yes. And that is one of the main things that happens to people who do that kind of retreat. You see, we offer that retreat in the context of 4 different kinds of retreat. We also offer silent illumination retreats.